This is Dr. David Stevens, your host on Christian Doctors Digest. Thanks for taking some time out of your very busy schedule to put some thinking into what's going on around the world and how you can make a bigger difference. This issue is going to kind of take a different approach. We're going to start at a basement level, a foundational level, and talk about the issue of human dignity. Really the foundation of most of the bioethical issues that we deal with. And joining us is Dr. John Kilner from Trinity International University, one of my profs when I was doing my ethics degree. And then we're going to talk about how do we teach others? How do we as physicians and dentists and other healthcare professionals influence our world? And Tom West, a physician in North Carolina, is going to talk about how he educated his church on this issue. And then we're going to talk about the application of human dignity into some of the areas of the world that we're seeing in the news every day. We're going to be talking with a dentist from the Middle East, looking at the problem of Syrian refugees and what's happening in the Middle Eastern area and how this is affecting Christians and how this philosophical base is so important to understand as we move forward. It's going to be a great Christian Doctor's Digest. You've got some great things in store. It's a treat to introduce you to Dr. John Kilner, a good friend and also one of my profs when I got my bioethics degree. He's the professor of bioethics and contemporary culture and director of the bioethics degree program at Trinity International University. He's also a senior fellow at the Center for Bioethics and Human Dignity. He did his degree, undergraduate degree at Yale, his MDiv at Gordon-Conwell, and his PhD at Harvard. He's written or edited over 20 books, many articles. He also does a lot of media from NBC to Fox to CBS to CNN and newspaper venues like the New York Times. In 2006, we picked him as the Educator of the Year from CMDA, and we're going to be talking about his latest book on human dignity. John, you've got a great new book out, Dignity and Destiny, Humanity in the Image of God. What does it mean to be created in God's image? You wrote a whole book on that, so just put that in a nutshell for us.
Right, yeah, that's a good question. Well, let me give you as dense a summary as I can here. The image of God has to do with connection and reflection, simply put. The clearest statements in the Bible about the image are the straightforward statements that Jesus Christ is the image of God. We read that in 2 Corinthians and in Colossians. In other words, Christ has a perfect connection with God and is a perfect reflection of God. Now, people, on the other hand, are created in or according to the image of God. They're created according to the standard or the model of Christ, who is the image of God. It was that way from the beginning, and after the fall, Christians are being renewed or created according to the same standard. Now, interestingly, in Romans 8:29, it reveals that God's plan has always been to create a human race that would ultimately become God's image along with Christ. So Genesis 1 says that God created Adam. That's both the individual person, Adam, and the human race as a whole. And he created them in or according to the image of God. Now, the vague expression that we're familiar with, Dave, in English, is the expression in the image of God. But the idea here, to get a little more precise, as the standard Hebrew and Greek reference works explain, is the idea that we're created according to the image of God. In other words, there's a standard or a model for humanity, and that's Jesus Christ. And Adam and Eve were created having many of the attributes of God that are perfectly revealed in Christ, but even they weren't yet all that God intended for humanity to become, because we read in 1 Corinthians 15, having a spiritual body and the attribute of imperishability, which means being unable to die, weren't even yet things that people had. So, in other words, the idea is that being created in God's image is about special connection and intended reflection. God has singled people out from all of creation, and just like in the ancient Near East, where a king would set up an image, as Nebuchadnezzar did in Daniel 3, and said that if you mess with his image, you're messing with him. So if you mess with people, you're messing with God. People have a special connection with God. And also, because of that special connection, people are an intended reflection of God. God intends for people to reflect various of his own attributes, such as reason or righteousness or rulership over creation or relationship with others, and ultimately a spiritual body and even imperishability.
Wow. How's that differ from what a lot of people think? I know some people have corrupted that whole concept and use
it for
terrible, terrible things.
Yeah, yeah, no.
And you think something as beautiful as that, how could you do that? But, I mean, that's actually happened.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know what? This, when I started studying this, I was amazed to discover, I just hadn't realized this, that this is one of, I'm not even sure I can think of another idea, that if you look throughout time, the history of the church, and if you look at even like biblically based evangelical Christianity today, there are like seven or eight logically contradictory understandings of what it means to be in the image of God. That is just crazy for a fundamental notion like this. But you're exactly right. We can talk a little bit about how that's played out in history, and it's been horrendous when people get it wrong. But yeah, to answer your question, what's specifically going on here is that the statement about people being created in or according to the image of God is not, as many people have thought, a statement that people are or were at some point actually like God in one or more ways. Because if being in the image of God was about ways that people are actually like God, well, then some people would be more in the image and likeness of God than others are.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an idea that's just completely foreign to the Scripture. I mean, all people, even the worst people whom we're most tempted to curse or even to kill, are in the image of God, according to Scripture. According to the Old Testament, Genesis 9, according to the New Testament, James 3, and that status isn't something that's diminished by sin. And, you know, that does actually make sense when we remember what being in the image of God means. You know, it's about special connection and intended reflection. And amazingly, God has identified with us in a special way, with Christ as central to that. And God intends us to reflect many of his attributes to his glory. And, you know, we may fall far short of doing so, but that doesn't change God's intentions for us or the image itself, which is Christ. You know, we're created according to that image. God intends for us to reflect his attributes. Now, of course, we did that a lot better before the fall, and now we need to be transformed more and more according to God's image, which is Christ. But note that it's not the image that needs transforming. It's we as people. The image is Christ, God's standard for humanity. We're created according to that image, which means that we have a special connection with God, and we're intended to be a reflection of God. So the problem, Dave, comes when people think, oh, this is talking about ways that we're like God right now. I mean, it's an understandable mistake, but as soon as we think in those terms, then it opens the door wide open for people saying, well, and we know what are godly traits or attributes, and look, that person or those people don't reflect those attributes as well as others, so they're not in the image of God, or they're not as much in the image of God. They don't have as much dignity. They don't warrant as much respect. And wow, how that's played out in history is terrible.
Yeah. Give some examples of that to illustrate it.
Sure, absolutely. Well, you know, we could take a look at the mistreatment of disabled people. We could look at the Nazi Holocaust. We could look at the extermination of Native Americans in the U.S., at the oppression of enslaved Africans here, at the impact on views and treatment of women. I mean, I'll just start giving you a couple of examples, and we can play out as many of these as you'd like. But just to take, for example, people with disabilities, where people have understood being in God's image and thus understood human worth in terms of, for example, rational capacities that people possess. You know, this idea we're in God's image because we have reason and rational capacities like God. But that's led to a lot of damage. I mean, societies have devalued people who evidence limited rational capacities, such as people who are mentally disabled. I mean, various Christian leaders in the history of the church, such as Thomas Aquinas, have considered the image of God in mentally compromised people to be, as he put it, practically non-existent. Protestants, too. I mean, Emil Brunner, for example, that people with serious mental disability or imbecility, as one nears that state, one's status as being in the image of God ceases or radically diminishes. And there was a world symposium on disability-related issues not long ago looking at this view that's been prominent over history. One of the participants said, "I became disabled, so I was once in God's image but am no longer." And that was a good question because of the way this idea has played out in history. Perhaps a little bit more shocking is the whole notion of the role that this played, and probably is one of the all-time lows in history for the use of this concept in Nazi Germany. The Nazi Holocaust, for example, is really a powerful illustration of how the idea of humanity in God's image invites destructive misuse when people understand it to be referring to current human attributes. And I just use Adolf Hitler to as an example. As part of his developing his approach to weaker members of society in his 1927 book, Mein Kampf, he identifies the stronger members of society as, quote, images of the Lord. And in contrast, the weaker members are mere deformities of what the image is and need to be cleansed from society. And one of his strongest opponents in Nazi Germany, Dietrich von Hildebrand, he recognized that it was precisely the proper biblical understanding and teaching that all of humanity continues in the undeformed image of God that offered the greatest defense against Hitler's destructive initiatives. And this is how he put it. He wrote, "All of Western civilization stands and falls with the words of Genesis, God made man in his image."
Yeah.
But, you know, lest we think it's just way back there or doesn't affect the United States, just quickly, I mean, a significant influence on Hitler was the government effort in the United States to suppress and exploit Native American people, as graphically portrayed in the novels of Carl May. And it's interesting, Hitler was an avid reader of the novels of Carl May and was really fascinated by this way that Native Americans were viewed and treated all too often. One of the greatest champions of those government efforts in the U.S. was Harvard professor Oliver Wendell Holmes Sr., who was father of the pro-eugenics Supreme Court Justice Jr., who wrote the Buck versus Bell decision, which authorized forced sterilizations of people in the United States if they had limited mental capacity. And this is how Holmes Sr. put it. He argued that Native Americans were not as fully God's image as the so-called white man was, and so it would be appropriate for the red man to be, quote, rubbed out. I mean, we go on and on, especially with examples of how this played out in U.S. slavery and in the view and treatment of women. I don't know how much of this you'd like to get into, but
yeah, well, I mean, you corrupt theology, and it has consequences. You know, often people think as theology, well, that's just what so-and-so believes or whatever, but
right.
Beliefs have consequences and deadly consequences for some people.
Absolutely.
And you see this in other countries as well with the genocides and Rwanda and other things where those people aren't like us, they don't have worth, you know, and even among the Christian church there, unfortunately, there was a demeaning of a different tribal group that led to a million people being killed, and this is, you know, but in the last few decades. So this is a huge thing. Let's get back to really dig in just a little bit more to the whole concept of what that image means and how that translates out then in action. We've talked about when you get it wrong, here's what happens. What happens when you get it right?
Well, you know, nothing less is at stake here, Dave, than human life and human dignity itself. And you're exactly right. I mean, Christians, I would say especially in this country and other countries where public life has been shaped by biblical values, we take a lot of this for granted. We have this kind of intuition that people matter, that you can't just kind of do whatever you want to people. We have this idea that human life is special, that human dignity is a real thing, and those are flowing directly from the notion that we are created in the image of God. In fact, it's interesting, both Abraham Lincoln and Martin Luther King did analyses of the U.S. Declaration of Independence and this idea that all people are created equal, And they found historically that that was rooted squarely in the notion that all people are created in the image of God, that that was the bedrock notion out of which that came. So, I mean, it really is nothing less than the significance of human life and human dignity itself. I mean, if you don't have that, then all you're left with is, you know, people is a combination of molecules that's adapted to its environment over time. And, you know, if all there is to existence is what you can measure by science and your physical senses, then there's little reason to think that human life matters or that it's anything more than me asserting my interests over somebody else, or, as you gave those examples, overseas, one group asserting their interests over another. But humanity's creation, the image of God, takes that outlook head on, Dave. I mean, it agrees that unless there's something beyond this world that gives people significance, then they really don't ultimately have any worth. But people are, in fact, created in God's image. Amazingly, they're specially connected with the God of the universe. And God's make it possible for people to bear the very attributes and excellences of God, and that's God's intention for all people. So, you know, such an understanding really is the only sure protection for the weakest of humanity. And remember, Dave, we all are among the weakest at the beginning of life, at the end of life, and sometimes various times in between as well.
Yeah. If not, it's just who has the power.
Absolutely.
Who has the power rules. Let's get into what you just touched on. How's this impacting our debates today and your background in bioethics? And I think people understand this, but sometimes we don't see the roots of the consequences we're seeing in our own society with some of the bioethical issues of the day.
No, that's a good point. And I mean, you can literally look at it across the lifespan. I mean, certainly starting at the beginning of life, the question is, in so many of these bioethical issues, what are we to make of human life at the beginning, you know, at the embryonic stage, at the fetal stage? And then you go all the way through life and you have various conditions that undermine our ability and our functions and various forms of disability. And then at the end of life, you have aging and losing our ability to do certain things, losing our productivity, and so therefore being looked down upon, not being accorded the same protections, not being as worthy of resources in society. So, you know, I think that at the end of life, looking at people as created in the image of God makes us realize that a person is a person. That person is specially connected with God. God has as much intentions for that person to reflect God's attributes to his glory as any other person. And therefore, their dignity and the respect that is warranted toward them is no different than any other person. And that's really critical in a utilitarian society like ours, for example, in the United States, where people tend to be viewed in terms of their value to society, their ability to contribute. Everything is assessed in terms of its productivity. But even if it's earlier in life and one has various disabilities or limitations, our significance, our dignity, Dave, isn't a function of our abilities. It's not a function of our productivity. It's a function of who we are, of the fact that God has created us and placed us on this earth on a journey toward an eternal existence in which we are going to fully become the image of God. I mean, in some ways, somebody near the end of life is even closer to that than those who are younger. And so, could warrant a special respect on that basis. And it really does extend all the way to the beginning of life. I mean, quite frankly, if you look at Genesis 1 and say, well, who is it that's in the image of God? Well, the Genesis 1 just breaks creation down into categories. You know, there's dirt, and there's plants, and there's animals, and there's human beings. And that which is human, as opposed to animal or plant or, you know, inert matter, is what is created in the image of God. So you just ask the biological question. I mean, when Genesis one was written. They didn't have today's science, but now we just apply today's science and say, okay, well, let's see. Are these embryos and fetuses we're talking about, are they human or are they other types of creatures or plant life or inert matter? Well, no, they're clearly genetically human. So that which is human, that which is a being or an organism, a human being, is created in the image of God and warrants the same respect and protection as any other human being. And that's what Scripture makes clear. Genesis 9, you don't kill, you cannot jeopardize the life of anyone, anything that is created in the image of God. And James 3, you don't even verbally abuse somebody who is created in the image of God, because, as we talked about a little while ago, God is saying by creating people in the image of God, if you're messing with them, you're messing with me. And that's amazing.
So it's like us saying, don't mess with my kids.
Yeah, he's exactly right.
Yeah, you
exactly
watch out, you're going to mess with my kids. And then that's what God's saying.
Yeah.
God's
saying
that.
Yeah, we had that expression, you know, she's with me, you know, so don't mess around.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
That's exactly what God's saying by creating us in his image.
And I think a fuller understanding of this is more important than ever because, you know, abortion, euthanasia, those things can be pretty clear. But as we move into even more difficult areas, looking at chimeras and combining genetic material from different species and all sorts of things that are being tried and looked at and human enhancement and all sorts of things, you always have to come back to this basic issue. What does it mean to be made in the image of God? And what would be his will for one of his children and being reflecting him. And so it is so important. I think this book should be required reading for every medical student in the country, John, because there's so much stuff out there that compromises on this most basic of issues. And that gets us into the mess that we are in healthcare and in our country today on ethical issues. Hey, speaking of ethics, update us on the ethical program at Trinity. We've referred a lot of our members there to Trinity International University and get their bioethics degree, as I did. You were one of my teachers. And I may not be your best product, but it's been a blessing to me. But I encourage people to consider this if you have an interest in this area of getting some training in bioethics, which I think is more and more important.
Well, thanks, Dave, for asking. Because, this idea of being created in the image of God, you know, this has a lot to do with, which is a surprise to some people, with actually the human body. You mentioned the kind of a whole human enhancement movement and the aspirations like, well, boy, wouldn't it be great, Vint, even one day to be able to upload our consciousness into an electronic existence and be able to then create whatever forms we want to. The idea that the body doesn't matter, just the spirit or the mind or the whatever. Well, this idea of creation in the image of God stands squarely against that. And so that's why it's so important to bioethics, which has so much to do with the body and the proper way of understanding and viewing and treating the body. It has to do with us as whole beings. So certainly body, certainly spirit, all aspects of us as humanity. And that's what the Trinity Bioethics Degree Program is trying to do. It's, as you know, from being in the program, it's trying to give people who are in the program a grounding in a sound biblical basis, a sound theological basis, equipping people to understand how viewing things from a biblical Christian way of looking at the world differs from what's going on in the world today, you know, the outlooks that are influential. And I think that really for a Christian who wants to be prepared to deal with the bioethical challenges of our day and to get the kind of training that bioethics can provide, a Christian program like Trinity has to do double the work, because we can't just say, well, secular programs are equipping people to understand things from a secular point of view, so we need to equip people to understand things from a biblically grounded theological point of view. Yes, we have to do that, but we also have to help people understand, well, what does all this look like from the various influential secular ways of looking at the world today or other religious ways of looking at the world today? And thirdly, how can you effectively engage those outlooks and ways of approaching the problem from a biblical Christian worldview? So it's like we have three times the challenge, but that means people coming out of this program get three times the benefit of what one would get merely from a, you know, a secular bioethics training. So that's the challenge, but that's the opportunity here now.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that I really appreciated was the fact that it taught me to engage a secular culture without use from a biblical worldview, without using biblical terms where they were not accepted. So I was equipped and given the tools to get out there and make a difference. And we've seen that with the graduates. I know, John, you have, how influential they've been in their hospitals, in their communities, in their churches, and in the media with how to deal with these issues. So
thank you
for what the whole team is doing there. And I want to strongly encourage our members. And you can do this part-time. I mean, I work full-time while I got my master's degree. Oftentimes they think we got to go, you know, stop practice for a year or something. You'll work pretty hard, but you can do this while you're still practicing, and many have. So
Some people are just taking like one course a semester. Yeah. Most of the courses are available. You have your choice of online options being done from home or coming for long weekends to campus and taking only one course at a time, even in the semester if things are too busy, you know, laying off and not doing anything for a semester. It's really tailored to people's life situations. We know that people are busy and they have a lot to do, but it's so critical in our day to be able to get a publicly recognized credential such as a master's in bioethics, especially when it's just a one-year program that you can fit around your lifestyle in 3, 4, 5, or 6 years, whatever you want to do. But then you end up with a publicly recognized credential. And in our day, when people, if they even sniff the idea or the fact that you have some sort of religious convictions, it's just so easy to dismiss you in public arenas, just to say, oh, well, you're just I don't care if you are a physician, you know, you're just religious or whatever. You have no training or credentials. Your ideas just come from your religion. And having a credential, a publicly recognized, university-based master's degree in bioethics, just helps overcome that, gives you a place at the table. And it's so critical that Christians in our day do that and not just leave this for people in the secular arena to get those credentials and to get those opportunities.
Yeah, and we just sit home and complain about what's going on and aren't able to do anything about it because we're not prepared. So
that's right. No, that's exactly true, Dave.
John, thank you so much for your time and especially your investment in Dignity and Destiny. What a great resource for all of us. And just appreciate what you're doing, and God bless you in the days ahead as you continue to impact our culture.
Well, Dave, I just want to thank you for all that you're doing with CMDA to equip the membership. It is just tremendous, the range of resources and service opportunities and equipping that you're providing to people. I want to encourage you to keep that up, and you certainly will be in my prayers.
Well, you can tell John and I have a mutual admiration society. He's a great man and a good friend that I'm just so thankful for what he's done for many of us in healthcare and providing us training and resources. And I heartily endorse, if God's nudging you, to go ahead and get your degree in bioethics. You know, you can do it with distant learning, most of it, trip or two up to Trinity, and it's a lot of work. I admit that, but I did it while working full time. It's possible, and it really can make a difference if you want to speak out. And then get a copy of John's book, Dignity and Destiny. It is excellent and should be in your library because this is the foundational issue for many of the bioethical issues we're dealing with. Once you can defend life and what it means to be human, you're equipped to speak out on so many issues. If you'd like to get a copy, go to cmda.org to Life and Health Resources or give us a call at toll-free 888-230-2637. We'll get a copy into your hands. Hey, let's get to another TaxWise moment with Jeff Anderson. Jeff, it's great to have you here for another TaxWise moment. I'm seeing more and more people interested in donor advised funds. Explain to us what those are and how useful they can be.
Think of a donor advised fund as this. It's a separate charitable account that a donor establishes with a public charitable funds such as National Christian Foundation, perhaps Fidelity or Vanguard. And in a way, it is akin to a family or private foundation, but it's a fund without all the legal and accounting fees and management and energy that a private family foundation would require. A donor-advised fund is easier and a more flexible alternative to a family foundation. And we're seeing this growing in popularity because many times a minimum to fund a donor-advised fund may be $10,000, whereas I've heard attorneys who set up private family foundations say, well, don't do it unless you have $5 to $10 million to fund that. And obviously a donor-advised fund is something that holds interest for many donors.
So when would be a great time to do this? I mean, what would cause me to want to do this? Things like, well, I can't decide what I want to do with my charitable giving right now. I've got more information, but I want to get it in this tax year, stick it in my donor advised fund, and then I can make the decision later. Is that one?
That is a very common donor scenario, Dave. You get the tax deduction when you establish the donor advised fund.
Or add to it.
Or add to it, exactly. And then you can decide when you want to provide recommended distributions to the holder of the donor-advised fund. You may be able to direct distributions or grants from the donor-advised fund over a period of years. Mm-hmm. It may be something that you want to set up in terms of a family legacy that even your children or grandchildren could continue to make those distributions to charitable organizations in the future after you have passed.
So you could even put this as a beneficiary, your donor advice fund, in your estate plan and then give your children or whoever the decision-making power to decide where it's going to go after you're gone.
That's right. And that is an important aspect of donor advised funds, is that you or those individuals you specify retain advisory rights with respect to instructing the holder of your donor advised fund where you wish those charitable distributions to go.
Let me ask you this too. I can see another use for this. I sell my practice and have a windfall, or I get an inheritance and have a windfall. I've got a whole bunch of money coming in all of a sudden, and this is a nice place to put my charitable part of that in a place where I can then disperse it over a period of time and not think I've got to give it all this year.
That's right. And it creates an environment of stewardship, Dave, where you're not under pressure to, I have to make all these charitable distributions this tax year. It is something, again, that family can develop a legacy of stewardship over time and even across generations to do.
How hard is it to set one of these up?
It's very easy. Many times, for example, let me use the National Christian Foundation. You can set it up even on the internet and just ask you about five or six questions. What do you want to name the fund? The Jane and John Doe Family Fund, for example. And then a few clicks and make a wire transfer or send in a check, and you have the John and Jane Doe Family Donor Advised Fund.
What is the cost for doing this? Is it expensive? What's the upfront part of it?
That's another very positive attribute that we're finding with respect to donor advised funds. Many donor advised funds have low minimums, $1,000, $10,000. Many people will fund them in greater amounts, and as you indicated, will continue to add to them during their lifetime. But in terms of management and overhead administrative expenses, we found many charge 1% of the corpus of the donor advised fund. And of course, you can work with the investment aspect of the donor advised fund to determine whether you want a more conservative approach or a little bit more of a growth portfolio so that that donor advised fund hopefully will grow and there will be even more funds available for charitable distribution.
So the money's actually invested for you while it's sitting there.
Yes, and you direct how that portfolio for your donor advised fund is invested, usually among a spectrum of conservative to, on the other end, more growth-oriented investments.
So you take your tax deduction when you disperse it, or you take your tax deduction when you put the money in?
Great question. You receive your income tax deduction when you fund your donor advised fund, not when the distributions are sent from the donor advised fund.
Right.
And this also brings up, in terms of tax-wise planning, Dave, another very, very important point, I think, to CMDA donors and members, and that is donor advised funds can also be funded with shares of a closely held practice, stock that's appreciated, in the case of National Christian Foundation, real property. So it doesn't have to necessarily be just cash. It can be these other more illiquid assets to fund a donor advised fund.
Jeff, you've opened up some new horizons for us once again, and I know you guys are ready to help with this and advise. People can get in contact with you. How?
They can contact us in the stewardship department at CMDA at cmdagift.org.
And there's lots of resources on that site.
Many resources with respect to not only donor advised funds, but again, that full spectrum of gift planning.
Thank you for what you're doing for our members, and it's just a blessing to have you guys on staff to give us guidance and how to be great stewards. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Dave. It's a blessing to work with CMDA members and donors each day.
Tom West is a good friend from many years. I've been in his home. The other day I was looking at pictures of us with our kids young playing in their pool on deputation when we were visiting them in Florida. Tom graduated from Western Reserve University with his MD degree, did surgery at the University of Michigan, practiced in the Navy, and then was settled into St. Pete, Florida, where he had a solo practice. In 1997, he had to retire due to some medical reasons that prevented him from practicing, and since then has been very involved in speaking out after doing lots of reading in psychology and ethics and theology and history and Christianity. And I asked him to come and share with us how he's been able to impact people around him and how he might inspire us to do the same. Tom's going to share how he did that in his community. Tom, it's a delight to get back together with you as an old friend from going back years to our days at Tenwick when you came out to help, and to talk about a very current issue, the bioethical issues that we're facing in this country and in our profession and the influence we can have. I'd love for you to just kind of tell the story of how God put that on your heart to use your influence in your church and community on some of these important issues, and how God led you and what he did.
I learned to value the fact that we live in this democratic republic, and it was very unique. And I assumed others had my idealism and felt the same way, and that even non-Christians accepted these values as best for all. I was trained to be of a benefit to society, assuming that our founding documents would always protect me under the circumstances that we would live and work. Unfortunately, I had health issues that developed later in my career and put me on the sidelines. But during that time, I was puzzling about why I was put on the sidelines. So some of my fellow Christians, we did a study of Job and thought about that a little bit and worked through those issues. And I began to see that, well, you know, I had something of value. I'd always been interested in liberal arts and humanities and literature and Christian ideals and values and so forth. So I began to read and study and think about Christian activities and bioethics and history, and with the help of some of the products that you were putting out at that time on the Christian Digest, I heard a lot of good talks and was directed to some good literature. And so I noticed that our culture was going crazy, the growing diversity and cultural change with pluralism. And this slowly eroded what I felt was unified, demonstrable evidence of the value of Christianity. And even by those who valued this for stability, and did not even accept the gospel. They seemed to be willing to wander away from it. So I felt that in my life that I had recognized that Christ was Lord, and that without external truth, confusion reigns, and that's what had happened. So I went ahead and did more reading, and I began to teach a little bit. I think I taught 3 different courses on bioethics in the early 2000s to my church. And as things became more heated, and I was kind of on the sidelines with my eyesight, I began to once again think of these issues. But the thing that really got me back in this issue was the recent decision wherein, by a decision of 5-4, our country can redefine a word,
mm-hmm.
just like this. And it, pandering to public opinion with no true evidence of the reality of the situation. I understand the reasoning behind the judgment, but I think it could have been handled much better in much different ways. But our society just isn't prepared to do that kind of thing. Anyway, you know, we've done that before. Roe v. Wade is a problem and has remained a problem. And
now it's same-sex marriage.
More. Yeah, now we have same-sex marriage. So that got me to thinking. You know, we can talk all we want about a representative democracy, but if a court can rule by 5-4 what's true and what's going to happen, we really don't have that much of a representative democracy. Mm-hmm. So I began to think, you know, maybe it's time to start talking to people again about values and about ethics and about, and the one thing I know more about than anything probably is bioethics, but, you know, it goes all over the map with ethics. So I noticed that the Christians were being pushed away from these debates. They were kind of being ignored or sidelined. And I thought, well, I need to let people know, because what I'm finding is that people don't either know about the issues or they don't understand them.
Right. And they're quiet because they can't defend their position. Even they may have a belief, but they don't know how to articulate it.
Well, even if they don't have, even if they haven't gotten to the point where they have a belief, They're ignorant of the fact that there's a threat.
Yeah, that's true.
So they needed. I felt that the laity in the Christian world, as well as the citizens of the United States, need to understand what they're facing if they let these things happen. Because anything can be brought down upon them by a vote of 5-4 by a group of 9 people. And I never thought I'd be concerned about that, but I am. And at the same time I was doing this, and Jonathan Inbody wrote his book, and that came out just about the same time, I started to think, you know, I got to get back in this. And I read his book, and I said, this is exactly what I needed for stimulus and also for a reference. And I think God made it timed this just right.
So what'd you do with it? What was the next step? Because, I mean, you've got the desire, you've put in the time to get the information, you had a great resource. So what'd you do in your local area?
Well, I began, you know, I had been working with my pastor in North Carolina. We have a split. We're in Florida for half the year and then up here for half the year. But I'd been talking and working with him and emailing him about issues about bioethics, and we'd been talking about it. But I got serious about it, and he gave a sermon about, I guess it was in late June, early July. He said, are you going to be a museum or a movement?
Wow. That'll stick it. That sticks.
Yeah, well, you got all these people up here who are retired. Yeah. I think he was talking directly to me because I had been emailing me. So are you going to be a museum or a movement? Because, you know, he doesn't have the knowledge of all this stuff to bring it forward.
Right.
He needs people to go with him and understand and take his hand. He and I began to talk, and we developed a curriculum. We called it Christian Culture and Controversy, which is pretty much what we're talking about. And we decided we would have 4 sessions on a Wednesday night with our Wednesday night service and dinner, and we would make a dialogue. And he and I would both participate. I would develop the curriculum and what we're going to say. And we had a series of 4 of these. The first was on right of conscience, because that's the one that really hits me between the eyes. And I think it gets a lot of people's attention. And the next one was creation and conscience, and that had to do with you know, looking back at creation and also how God speaks not only through Christ, but through his creation.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to understand that because everybody sees and knows that. They don't always interpret it in the right way, but it's there. So you need to understand that, and that conscience speaks to people whether they know it or not.
In natural law, what we observe gives us insight into the character of God.
So that was the next portion of what we talked about. And then I went into specifically bioethics for Christians, and I chose several areas. We talked about abortion and beginning of life issues. We talked about end of life issues and euthanasia and physician assisted suicide. We talked about medical access, but I didn't make it a total scan of everything. I wanted to go in more depth in different areas.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last session was, and each of these sessions was 80 to 90 minutes long. The last session was we called Inform, Inspire, and Interact. And the idea was that we were going to give people some tools so that they could go out and at least begin to understand what they're dealing with. And we had probably 80 to 120 people at each session.
Wow.
And that's pretty good for our little church up here, although summer really swells the populace.
What was the impact on the people that came? I mean, what kind of feedback did you get, Tom?
Oh, great. Great feedback. What I would do is I would develop a paper, a white paper, on what we're going to talk about, and then I would develop a series of questions and points, and the pastor and I would spend an hour to an hour and a half talking these over and then praying about it, and then we would go ahead and start our dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
So, but anyway, those dialogues were well attended, and people were rapt, I mean, very attentive. Now, afterwards, there were questions and answers, and some of them were good, and some of them weren't. But by and large, we could answer the questions and get people to understand our position, and we didn't have any huge negativity.
Let me ask you this, Tom. You know, you're speaking to busy doctors. You used to be one. You know exactly what that's like. What would you say to them? I mean, they have, like you have, incredible influence because they have that MD after their name or whatever healthcare degree it is. Some of them may be listening and saying, well, man, Tom's had years to dig into this, and I don't have a bioethics degree, and I don't have years to dig into it. What would you say to them?
Well, this is a problem that I recognize is truth. I mean, I know when I was practicing, I didn't have time to spend a great deal of time thinking about these things. I was, you know, more interested in what I was doing and making sure that my private life and my family life was all, you know, in line. In answer to that, I think there's a place for developing some help for physicians.
Absolutely.
Right now I'm working on a book, believe it or not, to bring forward to physicians, but also to lay people and pastors, these topics in such a way that they can be seen as a broad spectrum and at least give them a beginning of something they can understand. I think, though, what I would say is that the physicians need to be involved in their local churches because they speak more knowledge, or with more authority, rather. Even if they think their knowledge isn't that deep on these subjects, they speak with more authority than anybody else will because people know them. So I'd like to at least help those people, too. Now, Jonathan Inbody's book helped me a lot, and Chris Ingram's book, Culture Shock,
mm-hmm.
that helped me a lot, too. Those were two good resources. I'm not sure people have the time to read those, but actually they should take the time to read one or the other of them, because right now, it seems to me, I mean, we always say this, don't we? Right now we're in the most critical period of our country.
Yeah.
But I think we really are in the most critical period of our country, particularly for the medical profession, because I see what's going to happen to the medical profession is that it's going to become more and more secular.
And more antagonistic to people of faith. I mean, there's
right.
folks
yeah,
out there
right.
trying to push us out and don't want, and if not push us out, silence us.
Right, right.
And, you know, especially in the same-sex marriage issue, it's, you know, if you disagree with me, you're a bigot. So this labeling where it's very difficult even to have a conversation over something quietens people, and those on the other side of this issue have been very successful at doing that. We can be quiet, but we're going to pay the price. We're going to pay it personally, and we're going to pay it societally, and yet we're some of the most influential people on some of these issues. as we get into them. And so I just agree with you, Tom, that we need to make the time to do this. And there's two or three good resources and a few resources. Just communicating information from those can make an enormous difference. And then our appetite grows when we learn more and more. That's how I got involved in bioethics. It wasn't because I knew a lot. It's because it needed to be done. And I started speaking out and I learned as I went. So I'd say that to the same to everybody that's listening today. And that's what you've done.
Well, that's exactly right. And it's important to understand that there are resources available, and that's what I would like to develop. So right now I'm in the process of putting that all together and thinking about it. And I hope it's a resource that people can use. I hope I can get it disseminated in an appropriate way. I would hope that it would be helpful both to help physicians feel that they have a platform, particularly in their local churches, but also help give them some information, at least to amplify the megaphone that the Lord will give them in their search for a Christian bioethic and a Christian ethical system in our world.
Tom, I want to thank you for your faithfulness and the tremendous amount of work that you've done in this area, the people you've influenced, and for influencing us today. I mean, we can sit around and twiddle our thumbs and talk about how bad things are and what these changes are doing, or and be a museum for ideas, as you said, as your pastor said, or we can be a movement. And if we don't do it as Christian doctors, who's going to? I think that's the question. God has given us, as you've said, a megaphone that we can use. So thank you for inspiring us, encouraging us, and challenging us. And we pray in for that book and trust that God's going to use it to really impact many lives.
Great. I enjoyed it.
I encourage you to get a copy of the book Faith Steps. It's short, it's succinct, it's written by John Imbody, our Vice President of Government Relations, who's been working in Washington for years. It's a very practical book, easy to read, but will equip people, whether they're lay people or medical people, on important issues that we're addressing. It also has a 13-part study manual with it, so it's excellent for a Sunday school or a CMDA student group or graduate group or some other group you're involved in that you would like to impact. Get a copy from CMDA. Take a look at it. It's available at 888-230-2637. Our toll-free number, or just go online at cmda.org, look at resources, and you can get a copy today. Do you know anybody from the Middle East named Roy? Probably not. And you're going to hear from Roy in just a minute, but that's not his real name. He's a national from that area, but we didn't want to use his real name on Christian Doctors Digest. He's going to talk about what's happening with Christians in the Middle East and the whole situation there. And with Syrian, Iraqi refugees and all the conflict that's going on, you're going to get an inside look from an oral surgeon who practices there and has been involved with CMDA on the international level. And I pray it's going to give you some insights and some knowledge on better how to pray and support those who are going through this terrible persecution there. Roy, it's great to have you on Christian Doctors Digest to kind of give us an insight of what's happening in the Middle East. I mean, we're seeing the news, but you're on the ground there seeing it up close and personal as what's happening with the war going on in Syria, the refugees, but most importantly, what's happening with our Christian brothers and sisters. So why don't you look at it from from 10,000 feet and then kind of get it narrowed down as you look at what's happening there? What can you tell us?
Well, thank you, Dave, for having me with you. Actually, it's true that so many things are different in reality than what people see on the news. It is very interesting for us that the West gets an idea about what is actually happening. In so many places, we hear things, and sometimes we can, you know, open the window, and places they're talking about, actually, it's different things are happening. But it's very important that the people know that in the Middle East there are a lot of Christians. It's not a place where it has only one religious color or one ethnic group. It's much more complex than this. There are a lot of Christians, between 10 and 13 million in Egypt, a couple of millions in Syria, 2 million in Lebanon. There was more than 10 million in Iraq. And the situation is degrading more and more because they are a very easy target because of few reasons.
What are the two reasons that it's so important?
Well, actually, in these countries, the Christians have been always undermined, at least politically and military-wise. The Christian families are much smaller than the other groups in the area. Most of the families have between one and three kids. They take a lot of care on them and give them a lot of education and things like this, whereas the other groups have much more kids. So the number is growing smaller and smaller. There is no power in the governments and what's happening around. Some of the regimes that were already there were not religiously directed. So you can see that before that in Syria and Iraq, the situation of the Christians was quite acceptable because the parties that were governing the area were more of socialist parties. They are pure business people. They have a little bit of religious background, but they are not governed by the strict religious beliefs linked to Islam and the Quran. Whereas now we can see that more and more these extreme religious beliefs are developing. So it's becoming very hard for the Christians to survive in a totally different cultural and religious background.
What's behind the movement into more radical Islam in the Middle East? I mean, what is driving that? Is it poverty? Is it religious extremism as far as what's coming from certain religious leaders? What seems to make this grow so quickly?
Well, actually, Most of the Arabic populations were not used to having democracy. Besides Lebanon, that's the only almost real republic that has democracy. All the others have been ruled by a certain type of dictatorship people for the last 30, 40 years, where the same person is the head of the state, even though they are called presidents or prime ministers, but they play the roles of kings. So the people were not used to this democracy, but these rulers were pure, or most of them were pure businessmen. So they didn't care much about religion. They had good connections with the West in certain issues. We could see that in times of history, let's say Iraq and Saddam was the ally of the West in his war with Iran, and then things turned because the whole politics changed. And then suddenly these people, by big decisions from the West that decided that it's time to give democracy to these populations from one day to another, as if it was a button you push. But we really believe that democracy is a process. It's not like something that happens from one day to another. And suddenly these people who were oppressed for a long period, maybe also there is a little bit of aggressiveness in their attitude. So it is difficult to give democracy suddenly, and from one day to another they found themselves with a lot of arms and being able to do whatever they want, pushed by religious leaders because religion is something that could speak to the people who are in need. And in a certain low socioeconomic level, when you promise them big stuff in another life, then it's better for them to follow this line when they cannot have things on earth. So all of these issues, when they gathered, it made the Arabic population that was suddenly freed very aggressive and hostile. And this hostility, of course, it always starts with the Christians, and they pay the price for it.
Do the people there identify Christians in the Middle East with the West? Because that most people see the West as Christian, even though obviously it's much of it is not. They identify those two together, so these are easy targets to express their anger towards the West.
Well, one of the main issues is that historically, because Christians were much more open socially and culturally, they were more in links with the West. The religion is the same. And in the Middle East, in so many of these countries, they could express their Christianity, so you would see churches and things like this. And at the same time, the Islamic radical groups always existed, but they were much more oppressed during the dictatorship times because, as I said before, these guys are almost pure business people, and they run their socialist political party. So they didn't let the strong Islamic movements to grow a lot, but still these small groups that were there were always accusing the Christians of being the allies of the West, even mm-hmm. though, as you said, in many times it's not the case. And through history, people were killed, slaughtered, kicked out of their hometowns, churches were burned because they considered them allies of the West, whereas the West never looked at them or never considered their presence in that big bloc. And this is what we always see in the news, that nothing is mentioned, that there is a strong presence of Christians in the Middle East. And it's actually the place where Christianity started, and it survived until the last two or three decades, where we saw a dramatic drop in the numbers and presence of Christians in the Middle East.
Tell me, Roy, what you're seeing. I know you've been involved in relief work and trying to help many of the refugees who fled these countries, many of them Christian, not all. What is their condition? I mean, what are we not seeing in the news that you know is happening there?
Well, actually, it's true. There are a lot of refugees coming to different countries in the Middle East, like in Jordan. They are gathered in camps. There are quite a few in Lebanon. They are more scattered into the villages. Some of them are Christians. The majority is not. The majority comes from a Muslim background. It's either they fled because different regimes don't want them in the areas they control. Some others, they are accused not to be Muslims on the same level that the Islamic State requires. Some of them just came because they lost their homes. And it has been very interesting to see all these different groups reacting to what's happening with their situation and with the relief work that is coming towards them. The Christians are a very special group. They are not aggressive at all, and they've been really kicked out from their places. They suffered a lot, and they appreciate any help you give them. They would understand that we don't do this for any reason, and things are not coming from the West. Things are coming purely from a good Christian background and that wants to help other people. But I can tell you that their situation as Christian refugees is very, very difficult. For the other groups, I think it's a little bit easier because they are getting the aid of everyone, including the Christian groups, but at the same time from Islamic countries like Saudi Arabia and Qatar. But what is a little bit touching is that some of these people, and it was witnessed loudly in a few places, is that once they were in power, they looked at the Christians from a point of view that is like, you know, looking down at them. And then suddenly when they lost their homes and they were deployed to places like Jordan in the camps, they were helped by Christian people who have no interest in anything they can give because these people really cannot give anything. Everything is taken out from them. And they said in few clear times that now we understand how these people share about the love of Christ and how do they love others because they came to help us in a situation where we really have nothing, and we've been hostile to them in the last few decades, and here they are coming to help us and support us when now we don't have anything, and they could be actually taking revenge of everything we did before.
So you're seeing this as an opportunity for Christian Witness and the church in these countries where people are fleeing to have been able to have ministry as well as relief organizations and others?
Well, it is actually a Christian opportunity to show the real love of Christ through through medical or other types of help to these people. I'm not sure how much the church can do because the church actually is very, very weakened now in the Middle East because of all these reasons. Christians have been almost eradicated from Iraq. The same is happening in Syria, in most of the regions where it's under ISIS control, and in the few places where the church is still surviving, in Jordan the situation is acceptable, but the church does not have like a big margin to move. In Lebanon, a lot of work is happening, but Lebanon is small. It's a country that has, I think, 3.5 million Lebanese, and now with more than 1.5 million Syrian refugees, really the situation is very difficult. The church has very limited resources, and it's quite limited what the church can do. They still can do a lot, but there is much more need than what is provided on the ground.
Seems like a wonderful opportunity for partnerships with the West, with the church. They are bringing Western resources, but the local church bringing the cultural language and other knowledge, where partnerships could be very helpful in these areas.
Well, it's very interesting, this idea, but there is also a big feeling to be careful from what is happening from the West, because the old idea of, you know, just people coming from the West, throwing a little bit of food and money and leaving is not what is the best way to do things. And it has proved not to be an efficient way, and sometimes it can be even harmful. But a healthy partnership with the local church in ways where Christians from different professions, they could be engineers who would help a little bit to get the situation better in camps and in refugee concentration places, doctors who can come and do a lot of medical work. We believe that it's not only interesting to come and do some medical work to the people and leave. We believe much more these days in a long partnership between the Christian community in the West, professionals like doctors who could come and help the local doctors to get even more efficient, teach them things, work a little bit side by side with them in checking and on all the refugee issues, and then, you know, build this relationship on the long term, come again and again and strengthen this relationship at the same time with the local community and trying to help the refugees. This would build a bridge and would strengthen the local church and would give a much more efficient way of doing things.
I agree. There's guerrilla missions, as I call them, short-term missions where you come in and they're gone and have a few stories to tell, and there's long-term relationships and partnerships where it can make such a huge difference. And of course, as you know, Roy, that's very much what we believe in the latter. Stepping back again, looking from, and I know you're not a politician, but what, you know, as many people are listening to this, they see this huge problem and the conflicts going on and the persecution and the deaths and the crucifixion of Christians and just all sorts of things going on. What do you see from your perspective on the ground where things should be going? I mean, what's going to help solve this problem?
It's very complex, and the situation actually is much more difficult than just saying that there is one dictator here and there, and we should be giving democracy to this population. We believe that the issue is a little bit different than what is seen on the ground, actually, especially in the West, and what people believe in, because the Middle East is a very complex combination, especially with the presence of the main religion groups. There are the Christians there, of course, and they've been there for more than 2,000 years. It's actually where Christianity started. In all these countries, they were mostly Christians. Then we have the Muslim groups divided into two major lines, that are the Sunnis, that they follow the line of Saudi Arabia, and then the Shiites, who follow the line of Iran. And then we have also the presence of the Jewish state of Israel that also plays a big role in the area. Adding to all this, the factor of the oil, that is a major player in everything that is happening now. All these balances, they create just a very complex situation where we have actually to look a little bit more in details and closely to understand what is happening. And it's very interesting that the Christian community in the West understands a little bit more than what is just put in the news as like easy source of information for them, and go a little bit deeper about what is happening. We strongly believe that the Arab Spring was not just a pure idea of giving, you know, democracy to populations that have been oppressed for more than 3 or 4 decades. It's much more complex than this. the story of Israel having by their side strong Arab nations is one issue. The oil that is now a center of the world for a lot of the financial situation. Most of the world now is in recession, so this is very important. The different religious groups, the extremists like ISIS, they also play a big role. And we just see that sometimes, especially for the Christian presence in the Middle East, some of the leaders who were there, even though they were the close of dictatorships, but they were much more tolerant and open for the not only the Christian people, but of having a variety of religions operating all in the same small places, side by side, you would see a church and a mosque, people praying here calmly and praying there calmly. Communication was much more open, because when there is a situation like a socialist situation, the leaders are caring much more about, you know, money, business, and politics, and they would leave the small communities and the religious freedom at a higher level of tolerance.
Yeah, I've seen this in other areas of the world too, where the West comes in and pushes democracy and actually makes it happen to the detriment, really, for what's going on, because people weren't ready for it yet. And as wonderful as democracy can be, until people have enough knowledge and behavior to handle it, it very quickly just becomes another dictatorship, and often much more radical than the one you had before.
And
it's an enormous problem. How can we pray, Roy, for the people there? And you know, what you're talking to a lot of Christian healthcare professionals here. How can they make a difference with their prayers and their support and their involvement? Just speak to them.
Well, first of all, it's very interesting that they start to understand a little bit more about the situation closely, and that they know that there is a strong Christian presence in the Middle East. And if this presence is eradicated, this is going to be very difficult. So we would like them to pray mainly for two issues at the beginning. First of all, that Christians would stay in the Middle East and they wouldn't be pushed away by the force of the sword and the bombs and all these issues, and the killing would stop against the Christians. And from the other hand, that also in the places where radicals have not got so close, but still people are leaving by their own will, thinking that, okay, today I'm still doing good, tomorrow may be acceptable, and soon it's going to reach me, so better I pack my things as a Christian in the Middle East and leave early when I still can, you know, sell my properties and gather everything I have and leave to the West. So we would pray for these two different groups at the beginning, that they would stay in the Middle East, where this variety of and the mix of religions have given the very special taste for this area of the world. And on the other hand, the support that these medical groups would give, that it would be in close relationship with the local Christian communities, that they would strengthen them and will help them to, you know, side by side to face all the difficulties that is happening in the Middle East, and not just to act, you know, alone randomly, because that could be dangerous for them coming from the West and not understanding the culture. And at the same time, it would be difficult for the local church that would pay a little bit the price in some places when they would leave.
Roy, I want to thank you for taking time out of your schedule and giving us some insight and help and understanding of this area. And I believe that we can make a difference. We need to be in partnership. We need to come alongside our brothers and to help where we can. That's biblical. That's what the Lord wants, and that's what we should be doing. So thank you for what you're already doing in this area of the world and for your faithfulness.
You're most welcome. It was a pleasure for me as well.
I hope you've got a burden to pray for the situation in the Middle East and to remember especially our Christian brothers and sisters, but also the opportunity to share the gospel in these very disruptive days into the lives of people who don't know Christ, and we need to be part of that through our prayers and our involvement. I just got back from a CMDA trip, and as I talk to members, students, graduates around the country, and everyone's very concerned with what's happening in our country, what's happening in medicine, what's happening with electronic medical records and the impact they're having on practice, the bioethical issues, the huge decisions that may be made in the courts and you know, this summer, which are going to impact us all on the right of conscience, legalization of physician-assisted suicide. And then I see this renaissance that's happening in medical missions as God's calling out young people like I've never experienced in my lifetime. I don't think it's happened since right after World War II, and most of them focused into the 1040 window in these difficult-to-access countries and Muslim areas where it's dangerous and it's uncomfortable and where it's difficult to bring people to Christ, and yet God's raising up this generation. And then I go out to campuses, and students are so eager to be equipped and so eager to integrate their faith with the practice of medicine. There's just so many challenges we're facing here at CMDA. And as we draw towards the end of our fiscal year on June 30th, I want to encourage you to do more than you've ever done before. We have so many challenges and so many opportunities. And the thing that's holding us back is just not the financial resources to do all that needs to be done. Now, we're doing a lot. We're doing more than we've ever done before. But, you know, I look at, for example, our bioethical area. We have 1.5 full-time equivalents involved in bioethics and doing 30 states that we're fighting physician-assisted suicide in. What's happening in Washington? We need to do much more, and we need more personnel to help us. And that's ongoing support to the general budget. We need to do more in our Center for Medical Missions as we train new missionaries. And we have more and more missionaries on the field, and they're asking for help and advice and training and teaching. And on the campuses, you know, campuses are growing numerously across the country. New ones opening all the time. And so we need more staff to handle that in our campus and community ministries. And so the real choke point and all the good things CMDA is doing and the impact we're having is finances to expand to meet the challenges of today. So as you think about year-end giving, can you write us a generous check? Or even more importantly, why don't you do something on a monthly basis? Just go on cmda.org and say, hey, deduct this directly from my checking account or my charge card, my credit card. And every month I want to support CMDA so it's continual, it's active, and I'm making a difference. Only about 16% of our income comes from dues. It's your generosity that makes the 45-plus ministries of CMDA possible, and I want to encourage you to be generous, because there's no one else to really support CMDA but our members and those that we're ministering to. And I encourage you to pray about what God wants you to do. He's laid this on my heart. I see these as great days of crisis, but also great days of opportunities. That's when God does his best work. And we want to be faithful to stand up and be in those battles, representing you, doing for you what you can't do yourself, in supporting our medical missionaries and training them and keeping them serving actively and being your voice into our culture, fighting the legalization of physician-assisted suicide, defending your right of conscience, and then raising up the next generation of Christian doctors, just like someone paid so you could have that exposure when you were in medical or dental school. You need to be the one supporting so those that are now in school can get the training they need to be the Christian doctor God designed them to be. Well, it's been great to be with you, and thank you for what you've already done. Don't let me forget to do that. You've been generous. Pray for us. That's the most important thing you can do. Your prayers and power give wisdom, give courage for the battles ahead. God bless you till we get a chance to get together again.
Christian Doctors Digest is a production of the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. The opinions expressed by guests on Christian Doctors Digest are not necessarily endorsed by the Christian Medical and Dental Associations.